Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the LSC, those who are not from the LSC community, but most of you are. And we're delighted this evening to have Emma Jones Parry, Britain's ambassador to the UN, to speak to us. And I'm particularly pleased personally because Emma and I actually joined the Foreign Office in the same year. We were part of the same promotion. I think, well, there were 21 of us, if I recall, in those far-off days. There were 21, 20 men and one woman, and the woman was the daughter of the Foreign Secretary. And the following year, there were also 20 men and one woman, and that woman was the second daughter of the Foreign Secretary. And it's completely true. But anyway, even though I have ended up doing sort of odd jobs around the British economy, Emir has proceeded to ever greater things in the Foreign Service, and has served in Ottawa, in Brussels, in Madrid, then was our ambassador to NATO, political director in the Foreign Office, and since last year has been our ambassador at the United Nations at an extremely exciting and interesting time for the United Nations. Indeed, no doubt some in the United Nations think perhaps too exciting a time for that organisation. But he's ideally placed to talk to us about the future of the UN. His title is the UN at the Crossroads, and I'm sure as keen as you are to hear what he has to say. Welcome to the school.
Thank you very much indeed for the introduction. I'm delighted to be here. I could almost think as I listened to that introduction, I'm quite looking forward to hearing what I've got to say, but there we are. Our paths diverged. I didn't achieve the distinction of academia, which the director has, but we both, in our own way, found our own destination. I have to confess that he was one of the stars that got in. I think I was the 21st of 21. And the reason's very simple. I come from Wales, I'm a physicist, and that wasn't the normal sort of state school, University of Wales sort of tradition that the Foreign Office was accustomed to recruiting. The fact is now we recruit in an entirely different way. The Foreign Office is exceedingly diverse, and it's a transformed institution, which is probably why I stand before you tonight. On the 23rd of September last year, Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, said, and I quote, "We have come to a fork in the road. This may be a moment no less decisive than 1945 itself, when the United Nations was founded." Now, why did he say that? What led him to that conclusion? Well, the United Nations in 2003, when I arrived, was a divided organization. The countries that make up the UN, 191 of them, disagreed on the war in Iraq in particular. They were divided about the attitude of the United States towards the United Nations and the multilateral system. They were divided about how best to respond to the threats to their collective future, threats varying from weapons of mass destruction to global warming and so on. And the staff themselves were scarred by the attack on the United Nations in Iraq, during which some of their most dedicated colleagues died. And it was, in a way, the end of the age of innocence. The United Nations no longer being able to stand under the blue flag, actually immune from the attacks from wherever. Now, underlying all this, many people suggested, was a pervasive division that was undermining the United Nations, characterized in a simplistic north-south split. In this view, in the north, the developed world had been focused on the hard threats, security issues, conflict, terrorism, and so on. The developing world emphasizing the soft threats, hunger, disease, poverty. That's very much a simplistic division. The concerns of the developed and developing world can't be separated out into these distinct groups. Terrorism is not confined to the developed world. Ask the people of Bali or Nairobi. And environmental issues are not only of concern to the developing world if you live in the Maldives. Ask anyone with a seaside home in Florida what they've experienced this last winter. Of this last autumn. Left untended, These problems tend to reinforce each other. Disregard a failing state today, and you may face a bastion of terrorism tomorrow. Afghanistan showed us that. Economic and health issues can impact on our ability to respond to conflict. HIV is in the process of decimating South African armies, some of the strongest peacekeeping nations actually in Africa, decimating the states. If you look at some of the life expectancy figures from, I think, 67 in Botswana, 10 years ago, hitting 37 and headed towards 27. I can quote you lots of other terrible figures. Desperate people, under all sorts of circumstances, can be led into conflict. Humiliated ones can be recruited to terrorism. Not that any of that justifies terrorism, but environments can and do make terrorism more likely. And that's why northern countries like the United Kingdom place a high priority on tackling poverty, environmental degradation, HIV/AIDS, and so on. It's why developing countries share an interest in averting conflict, curbing proliferation, and trying to stop international terrorism. Now, it's easy to see the differences in the world since the United Nations was founded. But the issues that motivated those that founded the UN and drafted its charter were very close to those which are on our minds today. At their simplest, wanting to tackle strategic threats and promote social progress. Let me quote two bits from the preamble to the charter. We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war and, quote, to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. Or, we, the people of the United Nations, determined to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security and to employ international machinery for the promotion of economic and social advancement of all people. So both security and development firmly on the agenda of the United Nations from day one. Now, in response to his statement, following up what he said about the fork in the road, the Secretary General appointed a panel of experts to address, quote, the threats, the challenges, and the change, unquote, confronting the United Nations. The report of that panel is due next month. Their mission, therefore, to provide a foundation to recreate the global consensus that existed in 1945 about the value and the agenda of the United Nations, to actually demonstrate that multilateralism, the collective approach, can actually work, can tackle today's problems. And the panel, in what they've been doing, have certainly seen the linkage between security and development, which I've been trying to describe. I don't think I'm giving away any confidences if I say to you that the panel is likely to actually identify six clusters of threats to international security. In no particular order, they are: one, interstate conflict; two, violence within states; three, economic and social threats arising from poverty, disease, and environmental degradation; four, the possession, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction; five, terrorism; and six, an often neglected but vital subject, transnational organized crime. The United Nations has also been producing a set of specific development goals that should form the long-term underpinning of stability and security. And in that context, let me mention specifically the Millennium Development Goals, not least since they concentrate on that part of the UN's agenda that the West is accused of neglecting. They're concrete goals with a target of 2015, such as halving the proportion of people living on less than a dollar a day, reducing mother and child mortality rates, halving the proportion of people without access to safe drinking water. The first one, which should be achieved next year, but won't, very simply, that boys and girls should have an equal opportunity of primary school education. You all take that, as I do, totally for granted. Most of the world can't. Now, what the Millennium Goals do is provide a common agenda for the entire international community, be it the United Nations agencies, the Bretton Woods institutions, and developed and developing countries alike. But the first deadline, due next year for those kids, is likely to be missed. if the estimates are to be believed, all 8 goals will be achieved in somewhere between 2050 and 2150. That's the extent of the challenge that we have. So what we need, a massive injection of funds, hence the British proposal to create an international finance facility, which would use some of today's development assistance to lever large loans from the capital markets. And then these development objectives, which include quite specifically progress on the Doha WTO round and improved debt relief, they badly need an impetus. But the hope, the expectation, if we're lucky, is that the events of next year culminating in the General Assembly summit in September will provide the catalyst to bring all these big issues together and actually shape the way ahead to kickstart it. Now, in the United Kingdom, in terms of counter-terrorism strategy, we denote it by 4 P's, which are to prevent, to pursue, to protect, to prepare. And without too much alteration, I'm going to take those 4 headings and try and find a parallel in the current agenda of the United Nations. Because basically, we need to better prepare the United Nations, we need to prevent conflict, we need to protect our people, and we need to pursue the rule of law. Now, how can the UN better prepare for the next 50 years? Given that it is the only global institution, our interest seems to me to make it as effective and as relevant as possible. The UN has never stood still with its membership. It was 51 when it was actually founded. It's 191 today. Peacekeeping operations, now one of the best known and visible of UN activities, not even mentioned in the charter. So there has been evolution, but there's also been a substantial failure to evolve. Mandates tend to proliferate and overlap. New priorities emerge without any agreement whatever on what of the existing activities should be dropped. Getting ourselves onto priorities and outputs is something which the UN is coming to very slowly, but which is basic, actually, to improving the delivery of what the UN does. But the UN has made a start, not least following the proposals of Kofi Annan in 1997 and 2002. But the work now needs to continue within the UN Secretariat and in the disparate UN bodies themselves. A reforming agenda may be underway in the General Assembly. It's imperceptible to those watching it. More has to be done. And one of the most high-profile issues likely to come out of the panel report is reform of the Security Council. So a quick word on that subject, which is going to attract a lot of media attention in the coming months. The Security Council's primary role is to maintain international peace and security, and that remains as important as it ever was. The Council is active across the broad range of threats to international peace and security, and the UN membership as a whole has a shared interest in a council that is credible, effective, and decisive. Now, I have no doubt the council could be stronger if it could more closely represent the modern world. It would have an added degree of legitimacy beyond question. That's why the UK has long supported the case for expanding the Security Council itself in both permanent and non-permanent members. We support permanent seats for Japan, for Germany, for India and Brazil, and want to see a permanent member from Africa on the Council. That choice will have to be done by Africa itself. More non-permanent members would give us the chance to increase the voice of the developing world in the Council's discussions. And that must be right, because so much of the Council's work now touches the developing world directly. Whether or not we achieve any of that next year must be problematical. No regional geographic grouping within the United Nations has been able to agree who its candidate should be to actually be a permanent member of the Security Council. And you can see the rivalries. The moment we supported Brazil, I'm not conscious we got any recognition from Brazil for having done so. We certainly got a lot of opprobrium from Mexico and Argentina for having supported Brazil. and I can relate that to any of the other groups. That, in reality, is how it works. But being prepared in the United Nations goes much further than the Council. The UN needs to get better at coordinating what it does between the agencies, between the Secretariat, the collective effort when it operates in a post-conflict environment. Political development and humanitarian work of the United Nations should all reinforce each other, both in New York and in the field. And we need, therefore, more coherent delivery, not only by the United Nations family, but in concert with all the partners engaged in a particular country. And ideally, that coordination and direction should be driven by the government in that country. The problem is, in many cases, there isn't a government capable of doing that. The difficulty is, how do you coordinate? I'm not raising this for its own sake, but it doesn't make sense to duplicate scarce resources. It does make sense to make sure that you have a coherence in your deliveries, but everybody reinforces each other. But the problem is that those intervening all answer to different command arrangements. The UNDP answers to its board, the Secretariat to the Council, the international financial institutions answer to the executive boards. Trying to wield those into an international intervention which does the job on the ground, which maximizes the chances of success, that's the problem. And across the United Nations system, if we are going to be prepared to meet threats and challenges in the coming years, we need to be ready to act earlier than in the past. United Nations needs to consider whether, how it can actually do an early warning system, drawing on all the resources it can bring to play, especially those out in the field. But it's a sensitive issue because no state actually wishes to be identified with the description we're failing or we're a country at risk of instability, however you call it. But the prospect, you know, that best known of lies, I'm from the British government and I've come to help you, and to pitch up in a given country and say, I know you're about to fail, but this is my card, I specialize in failing states, let me help you. It's not a tenable proposition. But getting the state concerned, getting the international community to react, is part of the challenge. And to do so before the domestic situation gets out of control, impacts on neighbors and on the international system more widely. But preparation, not just about means and speed of delivery, it's also about having the right policies in place, policies adapted to the challenges that we confront today and will tomorrow. One of the most crucial aspects of UN reform is to ensure that we have that agreement on the right policies, be it eliminating poverty, be it tackling terrorism, be it confronting proliferation, whatever it is, what's the policy that saves us from the problems of climate change, whatever. Can we actually identify them, reach agreement, and then execute the policy? That takes me to prevent. Conflict prevention has been on the agenda for some time, and with good reason. The United Nations has a unique place at the heart of the international system. It's able to lead, like no other organization, in the coordination of the diplomatic, the developmental, and the security response. It has extensive experience in supporting state-building capacity and working with civil society to implement developmental programs. There's an increasing understanding of the need for prevention to address all the possible causes of stress on a country, be they economic, environmental, or governance, abuse of human rights, and so on. But if we can support human rights, the rule of law, then what we may be able to do is start at the beginning to tackle the feelings of injustice that can breed consequent conflict. The United Nations has a wide human resource base of experts at its disposal in the field. The UN agencies and programs, particularly UNDP, UNICEF, the UN resident coordinators, can play a vital role in gathering information, giving early warning, and in promoting dialogue, and above all, delivery on the ground. I led the Security Council mission to West Africa at the end of June, went through 8 countries in 8 days. They ranged from the successful, the Ghanas, the Nigerias, down to the Guinea-Bissaus of this world. Actually, if you see what the United Nations does on the ground, be it peacekeepers, be it the people trying to do the developmental side, or UNICEF trying to deliver measles vaccinations, having to make representations to say, please start again a policy of inoculation in the north of your country, because the fact you haven't, you so far had 400 outbreaks of measles, which have spread as far south as Botswana and have gone as far west as, I think, Cote d'Ivoire. Measles. Now, we've all had it, and we've all scratched, and we've had no repercussions. But something of the order of 400,000 kids die each year from measles. And measles was on the point of being eradicated until one government decided that inoculation actually was a plot to actually add to the vaccine something which would restrict the population growth in that part of the world, and therefore the decision was taken not to continue with the vaccine. Trite, simple cases, but all demonstrating why actually you need the international intervention. I can't make a speech without quoting Tony Blair. You'd forgive me the obligatory quote. I'm just joking as I say that. The challenges and the threats are of a different nature from anything the world has faced before. We must face the threats posed by proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, oppressive and brutal regimes, poverty, HIV/AIDS, and environmental damage. We need to take effective action in response to these challenges, and we cannot always wait for the threat to fully materialize before we act. It's not a bad summary of the sort of issues that the world confront and why we need to find responses. Now, the role of the Security Council in prevention is a sensitive one, but it remains essential. We need a growing consensus that the Council should act, should tackle emerging threats from an early stage. Now, against that background, the Council is thinking about how to review and strengthen the prevention response. That includes four areas for further development that I would pick out. The first, a more active approach to the Council's mandate under Chapter 6 for the peaceful resolution of disputes, including action to deal with internal conflict, but to do so at the early stage. Secondly, closer coordination with the Secretary General's good offices missions and regional organizations and actors. Good example, ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, which is playing an increasingly constructive role in tackling conflict in the region, in promoting political progress, doing a tremendous job under Ghanaian leadership. Thirdly, more consistent, well-targeted sanctions regimes, including expert support, monitoring mechanisms, and crucially, enforcement. And fourthly, the development of non-military tools for engagement and intervention, including improving police, rule of law support, and intervention to provide emergency civilian administration. Now, those sound simple, but they're actually crucial elements to putting together a functioning state which is coming out of conflict, or indeed potentially going into conflict, but they are the infrastructure which make a state work. Turning to protection, where, despite our best efforts, prevention fails, what's the responsibility of the international community to protect citizens in these cases? And they fall, seems to me, broadly into two categories. Firstly, resolving conflict between states and within states. And secondly, and more controversially, what do we do in the face of large-scale human rights abuse and humanitarian crisis? Now let's look first at the easier one, the established role of the United Nations in peacekeeping. And in doing that, let me list some of the key forms of intervention that the United Nations has, because the problem is when talking about intervention, one always thinks of military, and that's misleading. Having said that, I start with military deployment under direct UN authority. The intervention of UN troops, support on the ground following a peace agreement, usually under a traditional peacekeeping mandate. There's also been at least one deployment under a preventative mandate, the UN's former mission in Macedonia, the UNPREDEP mission, which came to an unfortunate end when Macedonia was silly enough to recognize Taiwan, and China then vetoed the extension of UNPREDEP. But diplomatic intervention through the use of the Secretary General's good offices, through his special representatives, through fact-finding missions of the Security Council, and also through the diplomatic work done by United Nations people on the ground day in, day out. The protective work, under which I'd include the work of a High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the life-saving and life-sustaining interventions by the humanitarian agencies, point I've made earlier. Now, peacekeeping is becoming ever more complex. Operations increasingly complicated. They integrate the military, the political, the humanitarian, the police functions. And as the missions get more complicated, there's an obviously greater need for clearer mandates, better coordination at the start of the operation. What we are promoting is a more integrated approach to the planning and the strategic management of what I would call a peace support operation. We're helping to get the UN develop the thinking on this, because the work ranges from improved planning of civilian post-conflict efforts to an improved ability to get missions on the ground quickly. Let me just list some of the factors which the Council is now taking into consideration in these mandates for peace support operations, which 10 years ago would have been unthinkable, but which are actually devastatingly obvious. At the earlier stage, we need to consider whether to cover the following elements. Support to build capacity for planning and management of public services, sometimes starting from zero. The financing of salaries in the civil service and the local military. So much corruption, even attempted coups, stem from the fact that people haven't been paid for 6 months. And I can quote lots of examples on that. The disarmament, the demobilization, and the reintegration into society of ex-combatants, sometimes tragically including child soldiers. And crucially, providing employment for these people at a very early stage. There's no point in taking away the arms, trying to reduce the military, sending people out and nothing to do and no income to be sustained. Because inevitably what happens is conflict recurs. And in Africa, on average, 50 to 60% of the conflicts reoccur within 5 years. The challenge isn't just to stop it, but is to prevent recidivism. Constitutional developments, preparation of elections, the basis of a democratic state, the rule of law encompassing a legal framework covering a law, sounds obvious, but a number of countries at this stage wouldn't have a law, police, judges, penal institutions, on the working assumption that if you've got rule of law, you're more likely to be democratic, and if you're more likely to be democratic, you're less likely to be in conflict. The UN is trying now from square one to address those many issues, case by case, whichever are relevant for the particular country, and actually get down to it. But getting the resolution right is only the start. Ensuring delivery across the whole range of issues is the particular challenge. Now, the UN doesn't need to do all this itself. A more proactive Security Council is now recognizing the role of other organizations also in stabilizing conflict. UN can build on the willingness of lead nations or organizations to carry out an intervention in support of the maintenance of international peace and security. Prime example, very topical, is the role and the deployment of the African Union in trying to resolve the situation in the Sudan, in Darfur, today. Next week, I travel to Nairobi for a meeting of the Security Council. It's the first time since 1992, and only the third time ever that the Security Council will meet outside New York. But the reason, so that the Council can address specifically and in the region the prospect for Sudan. We've already set out a very tough position on Darfur and given our support to the Naivasha peace process, the North-South conflict these last 30 years. The aim, a comprehensive agreement underpinned by the international community where all Sudanese have the prospect of stability and political arrangements meeting their aspirations. Now, somebody will doubtless say to me, why has the United Nations been so unsuccessful in Sudan? And let me just answer that question in advance by saying that when this subject came really to the fore in January, the challenge, firstly, is to get Sudan and Darfur on the Council agenda. as I said earlier, countries on the whole don't want to be put on the agenda. Now, they can be put on against their will, provided you've got unanimity. But some of my colleagues are less than enthusiastic about putting country X on the agenda, lest sometime later their country also gets put on the agenda. So there's a conspiracy. Let's not put the countries on the agenda. Well, we got round that. But what I would simply like to say, the expectation of the NGOs, the people who are following Darfur, was that by the end of the rainy season, something of the order of 500 to 700,000 people would have died. That's a terrible prospect. I, in February, said to my guys in a morning meeting, our number one priority for the next while is to reduce that number. Now, some sadly always die in the rainy season, but the facts show that something of the order of 70,000 people have died. That's 70,000 too many, but it's much better than 700,000. And it's because of the attention given by the international community, by the Security Council, to resolutions specifically on Sudan, and by the international effort which has been generated and which British ministers have been very active. Now, more controversial than the traditional peacekeeping is how should the UN act to avert or halt a potential or massive violation of humanitarian law and crimes against humanity. This debate, the so-called humanitarian intervention, is not easy. But we can't either shy away from it, because ultimately we do need to consider when is force legitimately used. And it's a tough nut to crack, but let me offer you some circumstances where I think you can be faced with that decision, and criteria which are relevant to a decision as to whether or not to act. Firstly, in the face of an overwhelming and immediate humanitarian catastrophe. Secondly, when a government has demonstrated its unwillingness or its inability to avert the humanitarian crisis, or is actively promoting that crisis. Thirdly, when all non-violent methods have been exhausted. When the scale of potential human suffering justifies the risks and the danger of military action. And if there is a clear objective or a set of goals designed to avert or end the humanitarian crisis, and where the military means are available and can be used with a high probability of success. I think it's also relevant that if there's clear evidence that military action would be actually welcomed by the people most at risk. And indeed, if the consequences of the human suffering of non-action would be worse than those of intervention, or substantially worse. Now, even if those conditions are met, it's obviously preferable to promote a collective response to the crisis. And we should then limit our action in scope to what is absolutely necessary, to what needs to be achieved for the humanitarian purposes, action which should be proportionate to the aims to be achieved. And of course, we have to do all that consistent with international humanitarian law. But I do think the case for being more prepared to intervene in the way that we did in Kosovo is very strong. In those cases where historically, and there are a number of them in the 1990s, where governments stood to one side for too long, we saw the consequences of inactivity. Actually being prepared to marshal force and where necessary as a last resort use it seems to me justified. It's also striking that the African Union, in the way it's now evolving, has set up a Peace and Security Council and has said very clearly for the countries that have signed up to it that if all of them, less one, agree that there should be a military intervention because of the situation in that one country, then that they would all sign up to the principle that they would be entitled to act. That's much further than the rest of the world has gone, and certainly much further than the Europeans have gone. But that's a recognition that if the state of affairs in a country justifies it, either because of a crisis there or its effect on neighbours, then there is an obligation to act. And I think we'll see more of that in the outcome of the high-level panel. That takes me to pursue the rule of law at both national or international level essential for stable and secure international systems. Much of what the UN is involved in the prevent category, is to strengthen governance, including the rule of law. In each of our last two presidencies of the Council, the United Kingdom actually scheduled open debates on justice and the rule of law. And the Council has been active in what we call the new threats, or what Kofi Annan called all threats in new and dangerous combinations, end quote. The Security Council has passed resolutions requiring states to implement domestic legislation against terrorism and the trafficking of weapons of mass destruction, in particular to terrorists. There was a gap in the proliferation regimes. The Security Council acted to fill it. Quite a lot of objections, not least from the proliferators among us, but the Council should so act. Is it democratic, they said? Shouldn't we negotiate a regime and take 5-6 years over it, and we might not even succeed? Well, it took us 4 months, but in the Council we legislated, and the obligation, direct and immediate, on 191 countries to stop the possession of WMD by terrorists and to stop the transmission to terrorists. I think a perfectly legitimate and proper recourse by the Security Council. At the other end of the scale, you should remember the UN is also involved in the punishment of some of the worst criminals of the last century through the International Criminal Tribunals on Rwanda and Yugoslavia. The UN is bringing perpetrators of war crimes to justice and seeking to end impunity. It's also involved in a similar role in Cambodia and in Sierra Leone, and potentially could do so now much more broadly through the newly established International Criminal Court. The aim, simple, to end impunity and deliver justice, a key stage in the application of the rule of law, itself a vital requirement to inhibit conflict, promote democracy, and foster a degree of reconciliation in countries which have been ravaged by conflict. In 2003, much was written about the United Nations in crisis. I have to say, when I went to NATO, people said, why have you come here? Because NATO is finished. And when I went to the United Nations, people said, you know, this organization is past its best. I repudiate that for both organizations, because they do, in their different but very important ways, respond to tomorrow's challenges, not just to yesterday's. But in terms of the United Nations, China gives us a very simple model. The Chinese character for crisis is made up of two elements, I'm told. One stands for danger, the other for opportunity. And that catches it. Some in the media are seeking to portray a second Bush term in the White House as a danger for the United Nations. In my experience, Washington comes to the United Nations over and over again. As an example, we're going to Nairobi next week because of the insistence of my United States colleague, United States Initiative. The UN is increasingly involved in the electoral process in Iraq, again, at the request of the United States and the United Kingdom. So 2005 presents us with a great set of opportunities. The agenda next year, from the high-level panel's recommendations in December to the Millennium Review, they're up for discussion at the summit, an occasion to bring all these issues together and to weld the international community to a way forward. What we'll be trying to do is promote a common understanding of the relationship between security and development. You can't have one without the other, is the simple truth. Sustainable development only comes in a secure environment, and you can't be really secure unless you have development. Consensus developing, I hope, around the shared threats, which should give us the foundation for action to prepare the United Nations better to prevent conflict, better to protect people, and pursue the rule of law. High-level panel comes out on 2 December. There's going to be a lot of meetings, much activity in the first half of 2005, particularly on the financing of development. But the United Kingdom will preside the G8 next year, as well as from July, the European Union. The common aim is to try and garner the different proposals and produce from all these meetings and the process which ensues next year a successful outcome to the General Assembly's summit on 16 September. Let me just enumerate some of the possible outcomes. More effective conflict prevention, post-conflict reconstruction and peace building by new structures under the Security Council to address this range of conflict, from conflict prevention, failing states, and so on. To do that with the international financial institutions and generally sharpen up the coordination and the delivery. On development, to secure a donor commitment to increase aid resources, perhaps through an EU pledge to give at least 0.5% of ODA, 0.5% ODA as a percentage of gross national income by 2010. An agreement to some form of innovating financial mechanism between now and then. I don't know if it's going to be Gordon Brown's international financial mechanism, but there isn't a better alternative on the market at the moment, and we need something. Simply, we need $50 billion per year, that's all. Further multilateral debt relief, more effective aid, with a closer harmonization of what the donors are doing with the multilateral contributors, focused preferably on what countries actually want. They determine their own programs. Tighter assured delivery of the range of Millennium Goals, and stronger, crucially, international regimes on WMD, tighter on nuclear, biological, and chemical, and reinforced cooperation to counter terrorism. Not just process, but actually solid achievement to try and tackle that scourge. I hope there'll also be agreed principles covering the use of force and the international responsibility to protect citizens when national governments are failing. None of that last bit is going to be automatic. There are going to be criteria which will influence a case-by-case study, but there can't be a blank check to say we should or should not intervene. Now, such a summit outcome could forge a new consensus on the full range of threats, be it poverty, disease, climate change, environment, as well as more direct security threats, the terrorism, the WMD, the proliferation. It's a packet which I think all members of the UN should be able to see their principal interests identified in and acted upon. I'm not asking that 191 countries all agree everything that's in there. I'm not asking that each of those countries find everything they want done reflected in it. But I do expect that the primary concerns of each country will find a resolution in this package. Implementation is going to be key, but as in most things, the crucial factor will be the political will of nations. This challenging agenda is worth the effort. If we can secure agreement, what we will be able to do is move forward with a stronger consensus, with increased energy to meet the threats, the opportunities which we now confront. That's the challenge. That's what makes 2005 a crucial year for the United Nations, I would argue for the entire international community. And nations can't get away, in my view, from flinching from the hard, the difficult responses necessary if we're going to follow the right road in the sense that Kofi Annan posed the challenge. But remember, in the end, it's not the institutions that bear most of the responsibility for failure. It's governments, the absence of political will, which in the end prevents us moving forward. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Amir, for a very comprehensive review of the challenges ahead. As you say, you went from NATO, which was under challenge, to the UN, which was under challenge. We'll be very interested in your next post. European Commission obviously beckons, I think. Who would like to kick off with a question? Yeah, I'll take the first one here. Could we have the wait for the microphones, which will be on their way, and if you could give your name and designation, that'd be helpful. Okay, I'll take two or three.
Jim Addington, Chair of Action for UN Renewal. Very pleased to welcome the talk by the ambassador, and note that the very broad aspects that the UN has to face. The one I'm most concerned with at this stage is, of course, the question of the origins of the war last year. And what my particular question is that the ambassador said that in certain cases we have an obligation to act, and that, I think, is that's the basic tenet behind it, but Was Iraq a setback to international law? Is it likely to be taken as an example by whatever country so that it may get become a dangerous example? And the crutch of the centre of my question really is, can we really face up to the real motives of those who went to war? And we've got plenty of explanations. And in that case, will there be any progress made in Iraq if this is not recognised, the real reasons for going to war?
Thank you. We'll take two or three because we had a number of them. Yeah, I'll take another one. Yeah.
Josh Kuczynski, British Humanist Association. I'm interested, you described very clearly the complexities of the operation of the United Nations in various ways. Would you agree that we need more education of young people in this country to understand these complexities and not see things so simplistically? I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. And a third one, and then we'll...
Yes, Keith Hindle from the United Nations Association, and from SOAS. Your talk was commendable in that you reviewed many of the important things that the UN is doing, things which are neglected by the media. But it's difficult to see that the Security Council is at crossroads. It looks more like dumped in a lay-by. On the most important issues, it really isn't functioning. Iraq, it did not prevent war. Iraq, it's not bringing the war to an end. I know it has a function there, but it's a very reluctant function, and it may not ever get to fulfill it, that is, oversee the election. So is there really any prospect of the Security Council becoming an effective institution dealing with these major problems, Iraq being the first, Palestine being the second? Palestine is 50 years old, and it's not the least bit solved at the moment.
Thank you. I thought you'd been clever in placing a friend from the UN Association in the front row, but if this was a friendly question, it was well disguised. Would you like?
I'm not going to go down the question of the legality of the war. What I will say is that international law evolves. And what I said about intervention is actually quite strongly influenced by the Kosovo case. Both actions and the response to those actions contribute to the dynamic that is international law. And the way we now assess intervention has changed post-Kosovo. I'll leave history to judge exactly the merits of the intervention on Iraq. I'm not either going to comment on the motives. For the British government, those have been set out very clearly, and my obligation is to defend the position of the government, which I'm very happy to do. But what I don't want you to do is assume that the United Nations is finished, in the sense of the other question that the Security Council can't act because of Iraq. I sat in NATO throughout the beginning of the Iraq War, and I tell you, it was not fun. We had one Sunday debate, which in the end we took a decision to provide support for Turkey in the expectation that perhaps Saddam would take action against Turkey, but it was hard pounding, and a number of countries, in my view, failed to meet their obligations to an ally. It's not an accident that the European Union failed to get a common policy on Iraq. The issue is actually deeply divisive and very difficult. But what I do believe is that both sides of this argument have actually genuinely held views which they can justify. The problem is you can't reconcile them very easily. What one should be doing now, I think, is to accept that we are where we are. The commitment that's been made to Iraq makes it all the more essential that we deliver the sort of Iraq that we went there to do, and that we last the course and create a stable Iraq where all the things we wanted to see for Iraq come about. And that's exceedingly difficult. And we know broadly why it's difficult, and there are some very difficult choices out there for ministers to make, and our soldiers day in, day out, bear the front line of that. But please don't judge the Security Council by it. Don't assume that the Security Council is dumped in a lay-by. That's very easy to say. From where I'm sitting, my problem is there's too much stuff is dumped on the Security Council for us to deal with. And if you go around West Africa, as I did, and I had, I think, meetings with 6 heads of state, 7 foreign ministers, and a range of others, none of them said to me, actually, what the Security Council is doing in West Africa is a waste of time, don't bother. They all actually were profuse in their appreciation of what is being done and which is driven by the Security Council. And I can say this because I sit in all the institutions and organs of the UN. I don't just sit in the Security Council. But if you think the Security Council is inefficient, you really ought to sit through some of the proceedings of the General Assembly or ECOSOC. We are delivering. But the two issues you picked on are, of course, the most difficult. Iraq, at the moment, the way out of it is to try and make a success, get the United Nations on the ground helping with the election and seeing if this path we have for next year of elections, then a transitional government, a new constitution, definitive elections by the end of the year, and then a government reflecting that, and Iraqi police and military who by then can take over the conditions on security which prevail in the country at the end of 2005. That's the goal. Very difficult to achieve, but if we all pull together to make it a success, by definition, we'd have more chance. Of course, Palestine's been there for 50 years. The fact that the United Kingdom sponsored Resolution 242 in 1967, but it still remains the basis of a deal. The fact that we still haven't produced what we want, which is a secure Israel living alongside an independent Palestine. You know the factors involved. I hope that the Prime Minister, in his determination, what he wants to achieve with the American President in the next 3 days, will actually get that show back on the road. But believe me, it hasn't been because of a lack of effort by any British government in these last years. But one thing you do realize is, if you sit in New York, is the different pressures that come to bear on that subject on the US administration are very difficult to resist.
More, yeah, I'll take one here. Where's the microphone, got to?
Ian Green from GG Press, Japanese Newswire. Given Japan's massive financial contributions to the United Nations, and given that they've agreed to forego the power of veto, what obstacles do you think remain in terms of them getting a permanent seat? And secondly, what do you think will be the outcome of the High Panel's recommendations in terms of structural reform? There's been a lot of talk about semi-permanent members or a rotating system and so on.
Thanks for another one here.
Tom Ketley, International Relations Department student. You talk around about UN reform and how it's been brought to the table by Kofi Annan. Reform, particularly the Security Council, has been talked about since the last major reform took place in 1963. What makes you believe now is a different time?
And there was another one, just stay with that. Yeah, well, I'll take those two more and then, okay. Woman with a scarf. Marie-Julie, yeah, there you go.
Hello, Marie-Julie Chenard from the Well student at the LSE History and IR. What is for you the most important reform that the UN must undertake to be more than the sum of its parts, and how can they do it?
Thanks. And then one directly behind.
Daniel Friedman, LSE student, Government Department. Looking at the details of the oil for food scandal, looking at the Dove report, and that Bernard Sivan was the head of the oil for food program, was, it seems, paid by Saddam, along with the details of the role of Kojo, Kofi Annan's son. Also on the list was the Russian presidential office, French ministers. How much credibility do you think the UN has after this scandal?
The rule in this school is you have to answer all the questions.
That's so. Okay. Has anybody got a friendly question they want to ask? Right. What are the obstacles to Japan's membership? Well, let me say why Japan ought to be a member. You're right about the budget and because of its contribution, and that's why we've long supported it. The obstacle to any reform is, can there be 2/3 of the General Assembly and all the permanent members agreed on the new model? No regional group has accepted, voted for any candidate from among their membership. The counter to the German bid is the Italians charging along saying, we think we ought to have just newly elected members of the council, and a cardinal aspect of Italian foreign policy seems to be to stop any other Europeans becoming permanent members, choosing my words quite carefully there. Now, in the middle of all that, how's that going to go? And the answer is, I don't know, because there hasn't been an opinion poll. I've got a sneaking suspicion that all the different options will fight themselves to a draw and there won't be any change. But the panel has suggested two models. One is 6 new permanent members, including the 4 that I mentioned earlier, 2 from Africa, so that's 6, and then 4 elected. Or 6 semi-permanent, as they're called, who would be elected, I think, for 4 years and would be eligible for re-election, plus 4 elected in the normal way and to serve for 2 years. The membership will have to decide between them. What I'm absolutely clear about is that the sort of package I was sketching out at the end should not be held hostage to Security Council reform. It's far too important, and as was pointed out, it's been a long time around trying to reform the council. Done it once since 1945, but only once. Why is it difficult? Well, it's difficult for the reasons I've set out. But the trouble is, when we talk about the panel and its outcome, we talk about reform, there's an obsession with enlarging the Security Council. For me, the reform that the UN started under Kofi Annan is all about modernizing the way the UN works. It's the sort of thing government, universities, business are trying to do all the time. It's adapting to change, it's working on priorities, it's looking at the outputs rather than just worrying about the inputs. Instead of just assuming that everything that you want to do new is in addition to everything you have done, you actually work out what it is that you no longer need to do. You evaluate the effectiveness of what you're doing. Those changes are basic, but they're not being carried out. And if you listen to some of our colleagues in the General Assembly, and especially in the committees, you understand that there is a breed of diplomat whose purpose is very simple. It is to be articulate and eloquent and to stop any change. Those people have to be seen off. So that sort of change is very important. I think perhaps the answer to the question about the most important institutional change, what I'd like to see most of, is to see policies in place which confront the challenges we face, and the implementation robustly of those policies done coherently by all parts of the UN system acting in good time. If we could deliver that, it would be, in my view, much more important than the institutional reform. But the third bit is, how do we reform ECOSOC, the General Assembly, where I don't think there are very clear views. An institutional committee attached to the General Assembly, sorry, to the Security Council, looking at peace building and the nexus of conflict issues, that I think will come about, that would be very welcome. But Security Council reform, as I've said, I'm not sure it'll happen, and although it would improve things, it's not the be-all and end-all of the future of the United Nations. Oil for food, well, the charges are much exaggerated, I think. Certainly the fairly scurrilous attacks launched in the United States on the Secretary General. The man who is in the firing line of having run this program, my predecessor, said to me, it's one of two things. It's either he's squeaky clean or he's the world's best actor. The people I know who worked with him thought that he was actually the one man who was committed to delivery in Iraq for the benefit of Iraqis. I don't know what the truth is. The Volcker Commission is engaged. The members of the Security Council have promised every support to that inquiry, and we'll see what it produces. But I know from the British experience, we spend a lot of time trying to get agreement to the adjustment in the price of the oil being paid to reduce that differential. The problem was that oil could be sold to the individuals with this permit, the vouchers to sell it. They were buying it from the Iraqis at a price some cents lower than the prevailing market price. Difference, that profit was substantial for the individuals. By, I think, 2002, we'd shut that down. But it took us a long time to do it. And it took us a long time to do it because the performance in the committee charged with looking at that program was very heavily influenced by three countries. And those three countries, when the facts come out, will be shown to have had massive commercial interest in what was happening in Iraq. They were also not very keen on the war, it has to be said. Is the credibility of the UN at risk? Well, it'll be diminished if some of these allegations are found to be correct. But these headlines, you know, if the OFF is as bad as it's made out to be, it's the end of the world as we know it. No, it isn't. It would be a blow, as indeed some of the other examples of the frailty of human nature which are displayed by representatives of the UN in the field. They diminish the organization. But actually, the aggregate impact of what is done, the objectives it's set out to do, in the end, must overrule these things. But our challenge is to investigate, find out what happened, and in the process that next unfolds, to try and avoid a repetition.
I think we've got time for one more quick round. Gosh, more than I can cope with. I'm not quite sure what decision rule I'm going to apply. One near me here.
Arthur Kreber, student at the LSE Philosophy Department. Sir, I'm going to ask you to be really honest with me. Do you honestly believe that the UK still deserves a permanent seat at the United Nations? And the same applies for France. Do you believe in a European seat, maybe, at the Security Council? One final question. You spoke very kind words about your United States colleague. Could you comment on the United States' stance on international support and climate change? Is this going to help pursue these United Nations targets?
I'm still trying to find you an easy one, but there was one over there, the front row there.
Hi, Theo Murphy from SOAS. So I do want to come back to Sudan just briefly. Given the Sudanese government's skill in playing off the different Security Council members against each other and their ability to sort of give just enough to avoid any serious action taken by the UN, what do you think needs to happen, either on the ground in Sudan, in other words, how bad do things need to get, or what needs to happen in the international arena for the UN to take some kind of robust action?
Next one, just behind, row behind.
Last week, by mistake, I parked my car in a no parking zone, and I got a parking ticket. I asked the attendant, why this parking ticket? And he says, because it's no parking zone, it's illegal to park here. And he said that the difference between legal and illegal only comes from penalty. So if you think the United Nations has declared the war illegal, so what is the penalty for the people who actually took the war? Because if there is no penalty, you can't stop future wars, because then legal and illegal doesn't make any difference.
One over here, and I think we may have to call it quits at that point.
David Wardrop, United Nations Association. I will be friendly and not ask a question, but make a plug, Samir. 2 weeks tonight in the House of Lords, Moses Room, we are having the Japanese, the Germans, the Brazilians, and the Indians explaining their case. And it's quite interesting that the Italians and others are determined to be there as well. So all are invited, and it should be on the LSE UN Association email network. But we, just coming back to the gentleman at the front from the philosophy department, we were going to call this UK and France no longer justify their places on the UN, on the Security Council, but we changed that to asking these four countries for a beauty parade. All here are welcome.
The one concern I have to say, is that England doesn't have a seat. It's actually held by the Welsh at the moment, but there we are.
We have to go a long way to try and get equality. Even the director of the LSE succumbs to that sort of comment. I'm looking at the quota of Welsh people at the LSE very carefully indeed. In everything I said, I was honest. And if you catch me in an untruth, I will be very disappointed. I don't go abroad to lie for my country. I go to actually represent my country and to do so honestly, fairly transparently, and above all, to have a basis of trust with my colleagues. So everything I said came from the heart. Permanent seat for the United Kingdom is a historical anomaly. I sit there as a permanent member by accident of, one, the calendar, and secondly, actually what happened in 1945. But in terms of what the United Kingdom does in the United Nations, what we do on the Security Council, do I justify my existence compared to the other 14? Does my team, which works flat out on all aspects of the UN, and I have 8 people who work specifically on the Security Council, are we perceived in the resolutions we put down, the contributions we make to try and get agreement, are we perceived as being legitimately there? I'd be very surprised if you found anybody who said, actually through gritted teeth perhaps, but said actually they do deserve to be there. We pull our weight and we have to work harder because of the circumstances we find ourselves in. But we do work very hard at it. Do I want a European seat? Missed out in my description was I actually was the director of the European Union in the Foreign Office, and I did 20 years of EU, not to mention 4 years of negotiating European foreign policy. But I don't want to see a European seat. I don't want to be the last British permanent representative permanently on the Council. I will strive very hard to maintain what I regard as a legitimate and a professional British contribution to the Council. In terms of the United States stance, I find it sometimes, if you'll forgive me, difficult enough to defend some of the positions I'm asked to defend on the basis of instructions I get from London. So I'll refrain from trying to defend or explain the United States. I'll leave that to my US colleague. The Sudanese, yes, they've deployed a lot of skill in the way they've actually played with different interests and views on the Council. And it's a government which has to be dragged screaming and kicking. It's also the case in the last month that the situation on the ground in Darfur has got materially worse, and a lot of that is down to the rebels. The question is how to maintain pressure, how to maximize the cooperation, albeit reluctantly given, but which on the whole is given. Now, it's a hard call to make, but if you go straight for sanctions for what you described as the robust action, the real risk is that you lose the cooperation of the Sudanese government. Now, you'll say, what cooperation is that? Well, in terms of two political processes, it is considerable. In terms of the access for humanitarian relief, which it took 4 months to get there, but it has been granted, and the people are delivering the aid. It's a balance between working with that, with sanctions and a more robust posture hanging up there, or do you go straight for? Our judgment, the judgment of ministers, is that we're better maintaining the potential threat. Actually, next week, in a resolution, the United Kingdom, as a permanent member, has put down on the future of Sudan, has put down a heavily conditional carrot. It says to Sudan, if you actually sort your act out, if you stop what's happening in Darfur, if you do reach agreement on a united Sudan where there's devolution or something, then you can expect a peacekeeping operation, peace support from the United Nations, IFIs, European Union, African Union, and so on. It's a substantial but conditional carrot. Our judgment is we're better doing that so far. In terms of legality in the war, well, I've answered that. I'm not very good at answering car parking fences because I pay all my fines. But the views expressed by government are their best shot at what they consider the arguments to be. And the British government has set out very clearly its position, and it rests on that position.
Amir, thank you very much for coming this evening. It's been a very privileged occasion, I think, for the school. We've had a very broad canvas painted for us of all the things that the UN is doing, and particularly all the reform programmes underway. You've been very candid in saying what you think the outcome of those might be, which is certainly more than we could reasonably have expected from you, and you've taken a very broad range of questions, and it took me a long time to find a friendly one, but I finally
that
did.
That was more an advertisement.
More an advertisement, but at least it was a sympathetic advertisement, I think. Very grateful to you for coming. I think one of the very positive things about the evolution of the diplomatic service, certainly since I left it, is that British ambassadors are now more prepared to put themselves up on platforms and to answer questions than used to be the case, and I think that's extremely positive and very helpful to the debate. And so I hope everybody will join me in thanking you for spending an evening with us.